People can join anyway. So,
yeah, we're recording.
You're recording now. Okay.
Yep.
Great. Well, one of the advantages of being locked down for a while is that you have a chance to study things that you've always wanted to do, and I haven't always had the time to do it. And so I decided that some time I've been wanting to look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, see what I could learn from them, that I would do that. And I spent quite a bit of time on it. And the way it's going to work tonight is that I'm going to tell you the usual sort of stuff, the stories behind it, what it involved, and so on. And then later on, whenever that happens to be, might be around the 8 o'clock mark, putting how much time we've got, we are going to then look at some particular scrolls. So if anything catches your interest as we go through it, we won't have time to look at too many of them, I dare say. But I've got some separate shorter presentations on some of the main scrolls that might be of interest. Okay, so let's begin the story, if you like, so that we've all got the main facts and understanding of what this is about. Everyone's heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but as I say, a few weeks ago, I got very rudimentary knowledge of it and discovered a lot more. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, if I can get this to work. They were discovered between 1947, when the first ones were discovered, right up to 1954. That's over a 7-year period. And altogether, 930 documents were found at Qumran, on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. And when they were dated, they span from 250 BC to 50 AD, although the vast majority of them are mainly in the 100 years between 150 to 50 BC. And they were found in or near this place called Qumran, which most people perhaps have heard of Qumran itself. But it's on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. You can see there precisely where it is. And to give you a bit of location, you've got Jerusalem and Bethlehem fairly nearby, Jericho, just north, and then further down the Dead Sea, you've got places like Ein Gedi and Masada. And I'm sure, again, you know, the Dead Sea is below sea level, one of the lowest, the lowest point on the Earth's surface, and Jerusalem is up in the hills. So although it's only about 37 kilometres away from Jerusalem, it is a huge drop to make that particular journey down from Jerusalem to Qumran. And if you're ever in the area and want to do this, if you want to leave Jerusalem, you take this road, travel about 37 kilometres, down, down, down. You go past the big sign that says sea level, and then up and onwards you're below sea level. You get to a T-junction, and if you turn left, you'll end up in Jericho. If you turn right, you'll come back round towards Qumran, and then down towards Ein Gedi, which is here, and Masada, which is further down there. So Qumran is around here, and actually there's a settlement there. So when I mention Qumran, eventually it will be Qubet Qumran. And the caves that we're going to be talking about are just outside here in the hills around it. nearby as well is a wadi called the Wadi Qumran. It's a dried up riverbed like a wadi is most of the year, but it does eventually fill in the winter with the winter rains. So there's a water supply for that particular community, even though they're 400 metres below sea level. And of course the Dead Sea isn't drinkable at all. And just to go back to that, you might also be aware that the reason this is so deep and low is that it's part of what's called the Great Rift Valley, the African Rift Valley, which goes all the way down into Africa. So it's a huge crack in the Earth's surface, or drop in the Earth's surface, and it's part of that. So there's 930 documents that were found in total, of which 230, which is around, what is that, around a quarter, are copies of Old Testament books. And you get every single book of the Old Testament except for Esther. Why Esther is missing, speculation is it's a book that doesn't contain the name of God. It relates to the Persian period. It's just a bit of an oddity. And in fact, at the time, this is interesting, at the time of the Qumran sect, the whole of the Old Testament wasn't fixed as a canon, if you like. So although they were very clear on the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms, some of these extra books of the writings, although they were known about, they weren't actually regarded quite in the same way as being biblical. Of course, they didn't have a fixed canon in the sense of putting it all together into a single volume. They just had separate books. But Esther would be one of those that would be regarded as slightly less important, perhaps. But one of the features of all these scrolls that were found, particularly the Old Testament texts, is that these manuscripts are 1,000 years earlier than anything that they had before, and confirmed the accuracy of these manuscripts from the Middle Ages. The earliest ones before then was a codex called Aleppo in 900, and the Leningrad codex, which apparently is quite a famous one that scholars use for translating from, but that was around 1,000. So by going back 1,000 years earlier, it was interesting to make a comparison. Of all the other texts that were found, about 250 of them are what's called non-sectarian, which means they refer to Judaism as a whole. They tell you things that relate to all Jewish groups. And 350 of them, though, are specifically about this special sect of Qumran. So they're known as sectarian documents from that point of view. And the rest of them, you can't tell what they are because they're too fragmentary. And that's the problem with a lot of these documents. A lot of them were very, very fragmentary or in very poor shape. So, but none of those 100 are biblical books. So all the biblical ones are in the 230. Now, you may have heard this story before, but let me take you through it. It's the spring of 1947. And the only people that lived in that area were Bedouin. And the Bedouin had their sheep and their goats. They were shepherds, basically. And goats like to climb. And one of them climbed up a cliff and disappeared. Seemed to enter into a cave. And the Bedouin shepherd boy, having lost a goat, thought, I can't be bothered to climb up there. I'll just try and scare him out. So he flung a pebble into the cave, and he heard it go ping, when it should really have gone thud. He thought, that's strange. So he flung another one up there, and it also went ping. So he thought, oh, I'm going to investigate. So he did scramble up there, and he realized that what he'd hit was two earthenware jars. And when he looked more closely into them, found there were 7 scrolls. I'm afraid history doesn't record what happened to the goat. We'll have to assume that somehow it got out and survived. But as I say, the history now transfers not to the goat, but to the jars and the scrolls that were in there. So this shepherd boy took his find back to the Bedouin, and they couldn't read or write, so they didn't have a clue what they got, but they thought, well, this might be worth something. So every now and again, when they went to trade nearby, which would be Bethlehem, they took these with them on this occasion, thinking that they would at least be able to sell them and get something from them, which they did. Let me show you a picture of what that cave was like. It's highlighted, otherwise you might miss it. but there is Qumran Cave 1. Now, the caves at Qumran are very sort of poetically named as Cave 1, Cave 2, Cave 3, and we'll see how many in a minute. But Cave 1 is where the original finds were made. So that's where the goat went, that's where the pebbles went, and that's where the jars were found. Just 2 jars, 7 scrolls. So Qumran Cave 1. So they took them to Bethlehem, and they found a guy there who actually was a cobbler and an antiquities dealer. I won't go into all the details of this, but it's quite fascinating if you do decide you want to read up more on this. But they sold them on to this guy called Kando. He decided to split them up, these 7 scrolls, that is, all 7, into 2 groups of 3 and 4. He sold 4 to the head of the Syrian church in Jerusalem, And eventually three others ended up at a professor at a Hebrew university, in Jerusalem, both in Jerusalem. Okay. Now, the story develops that this guy who headed up the Syrian church eventually sold them on, so they all ended up at the Hebrew university in Jerusalem. And what the story about him selling them on is that he eventually moved from that area, traveled to North America, and decided to place an ad in the Wall Street Journal in the miscellaneous for sale section. You know, four ancient scrolls for sale, who wants them, sort of thing. Well, someone did, and they ended up back in Jerusalem. But the main point of that is that that meant all seven were very soon published, and photos of them were available, and they very quickly got out into the public domain. The other thing to be aware of is this is 1947, and the spring of 1947. So what are we talking about here? What happened then? Well, this was the end of the British mandate in the region. And Britain handed over the mandate back to the League of Nations then. And before long, the League of Nations. Anyway, before long, the partition came along so that Jordan had that bit of territory, including East Jerusalem. So it was actually the Jordanian jurisdiction that had control of this area, and therefore they had control of who looked at the scrolls. And they set up a team of scholars to look at it, but there were no Israelis, no Jewish people involved in the original team of scholars. Eventually, of course, in June 1967, when Israel captured East Jerusalem and the West Bank, they were able to make changes, but they didn't kick out all the scholars, they just added some of their own over time. And in the end, that meant they had control of nearly all the scrolls, though some remained in Jordan. So there's a lot of other intrigue about all this, which depends upon, you know, the politics and the history of the time and what was going on in that particular area. But because it was in that particular area, it meant that Jordanian control was important in the early days. So what were these original seven scrolls then? Why were they so important? Everybody, I think, has heard the fact that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there was copies of Isaiah. Well, in fact, they found two copies of Isaiah, one that was complete and one that was incomplete. The incomplete one was about half of it. But the great thing about this, even though it was only half, was that it was very closely resembling the copies of Isaiah on which already the Bible translations were using, in wording and spelling and everything. So that confirmed the accuracy of the Bible translations that we already had. The fact that there was another complete Isaiah is interesting, but that did differ from the other copies, the medieval ones that were used in translation. And the reason for that is that, I might say more about this later, but the Dead Sea sect didn't always use the same Hebrew as others in the area. It was part of their desire to be exclusive. Apparently groups do this when they sort of hive themselves off from the main group and want to be regarded as different, is they take the language and they fiddle around with it a little bit and create a sort of new version of it. So what they did, as well as obviously having and copying out the original Isaiah, they had a bit more of an updated version, only in terms of the words used. It wasn't changed in terms of anything else. So that's why that one didn't match perfectly with what was already there. And then the others that were found were something called the Thanksgiving Hymns. That's a collection of praises similar to the Psalms. There was something called the War Scroll. And that's fascinating because that shows how the Dead Sea sect regarded themselves as the sons of light, and their enemies, the sons of darkness, but their enemies were other Jews. not pagans or Romans or anything. This was a battle between the sons of light themselves and the sons of darkness, the other Jewish groups, mainly in Jerusalem. And this is where you come up against, or read a lot about their apocalyptic views and how the world was going to end, this big battle, and how, of course, they would come out on top. So these scrolls I'm mentioning now, when we get to the sort of second half of the evening, say, what would you like to look at or see in more detail? If something here stirs your interest, then I've got a shorter presentation on each of those. And also in here was the what's called the community rule or the manual of discipline, which showed the theological ideas of the community and how they organized their life. So this would be quite a long scroll. And then there was something called Pesha Habakkuk. A Pesha is, well, they would call it a form of commentary, but it's nothing like the sort of commentaries that we have. It's a total reinterpretation. So to us, it'd be totally unrecognizable as relating to Habakkuk at all, except what they do is they quote a verse from Habakkuk and then say, and its Pesha is. And what they mean by that is, well, this is what it really means. Forget about Habakkuk and his day and what it meant then. We're updating it for you so you understand it now. And to be honest, it bears no resemblance to anything as such in the text. It always sort of boosts them at the expense of other Jewish groups. So they're not a huge amount of value. It doesn't add to our understanding of, say, Habakkuk. And there were lots of these Pesha or Peshurim, all sorts of different books had them. Had their Pesha, but again, it's all very fanciful and not that relevant to us. And then there's something which eventually became known as the Genesis Apocryphon, and that was actually in Aramaic, and it was an expansive retelling of certain parts of the book of Genesis. Now, this was in a very poor state and difficult to read, but eventually that's what they realized they were looking at. Very expansive retellings of, say, the flood and the life of Abraham, and even adding lots of extra details in there, reading between the lines. So when it says that Sarah was very beautiful, we suddenly stop and get a great long sort of hymn of praise to the beauty of Sarah, a bit like suddenly reading the Song of Solomon within that context. So again, very fanciful in some ways. But those were the original seven scrolls that were found in that cave one. Obviously, once something like this had been discovered in a cave, and as I explained very briefly, how they were sold on, became known throughout the scholarly world, and were soon published, people thought, well, there must be some more, surely. Let's go and have a good look around the area and see what else we can find. So scholarly teams set off from 1948 to 54. They searched the whole area in great detail, and eventually discovered 11 caves, that's 10 more in other words, that had more scrolls in them, which is how we get up to 930. Although some of them, as I said, were in a very poor state. They weren't all in these nice jars. Some of them were just sort of thrown in the back of the cave and lying on the floor. One cave that had a lot in it, Cave 4, had over 500 scrolls in various states. And there weren't just scrolls in these caves as well. They found things like textiles, pottery, remains of bits of food and things like date seeds and things like that. But that's where this total of 930 actually comes from, in 11 caves. And nearby there was the ruins of a settlement which is called Kerbet Qumran, and Kerbet is just the Arabic name for an archaeological ruin. So all it means is at Qumran, there was a ruin. And so that site was also excavated, and that's how we began to learn a lot more about it. So this is some maps now of how it sort of generally looks. So we're still on the shore of the Dead Sea, but that's off the map. So here's this settlement that we're talking about, not a town, anything like that, just a community settlement. There's a scale here, which might help us to get our bearings. But cave one is over here. So when I showed you that picture of it, it's some distance away. You can sort of try and work out where it was, but within walking distance. Next to it was found another cave, because obviously they started searching around here to start with. There's cave two. And then they found another cave over here. And then here's cave four, where they had all these. And so around here, they found all these other caves. Well, they didn't find the caves, the caves were there. You know what I mean? They explored the caves and found these things in them. And then at the end, in cave 11, they found something more up there. So that's how the situation developed around this settlement. And here we are back again, where that's cave one that I showed you before. If you look at it like this, you think, is that really a cave? What's going on there? But, you know, it's a nice little place for a goat to go. So why shouldn't there be something else in there? And if you go back to the previous one, cave two is very near to it, just a few feet, really. So forward again. There it is. And Kerbit Cumran is further down here. It's going further south again. I've no idea what this is. So that's those two. And that's the famous cave four. If ever you see a picture of a cave of Qumran, that's nearly always the one you'll see in a book. And that's cave four, where they found most of them. Not the original one, but where they found most of them. And you can see there that actually that's quite a decent opening, and there's probably a lot of space in here. And that's back down near to where the settlement was. And then on this next picture, again, quite like this one, because you can see, I find it, that's where caves one and two were. So when I showed you them before, this is now where they are. This is the settlement, which we'll look at in more detail. These are some, well, that's the cave four that I've just shown you. And then further north was 3 and 11. So that shows how they were spread out, but all within walking distance, even these over here. Okay. And the sea is just off the map to that side. So the settlement, known as Kerbet Cumran, was excavated from 1951 onwards. And some famous people got involved in that. Someone that I've heard of was Roland DeVoe. Actually, it was largely Catholics, Catholic priests that came and did this sort of work. And so some of the understanding of this was based upon what they thought it ought to be like. So that they brought their understanding of Catholicism or Christianity of that kind to the situation and made some wrong deductions on it. I'll come back to that later. But they explored the area in great detail. Didn't find any more scrolls after that. So that was obviously it. They kept finding coins and other artifacts. And eventually they uncovered a cemetery, which is interesting and worth another mention later, and pathways to the caves. So they sort of emerged as they excavated the area, which showed how they did used to walk a lot between the caves and the area. They kept finding things like old sandal nails and things like that as evidence that people in those days walked to it. So this is the enlarged version of this community area. And I'm going to get my directions model up at the moment, but there's another map in a minute which will put it back right again. But you start to see some of the features on it as they excavated it as to where they lived. So let's do this one next then. Now, you can see here, this tells you it's looking southwest, if that helps you to orientate yourself. I still get muddled up. I think if you're looking southwest, you're standing in the northeast, aren't you, or something? Mm. But it shows you the different features that they uncovered. The main one here is a tower, was built up. They had an aqueduct, so they could bring the water in from that wadi in the winter and fill up their cisterns. And there's a cistern over here. You probably was expecting that there would be a scriptorium, but they also had other rooms, but they were all communal rooms. There were no private houses or small rooms where they stayed. So one option is actually they didn't necessarily sleep here overnight. Did they actually go and sleep in the caves? People wonder that. But they might have slept in the main assembly and dining hall. Okay. In case you're wondering how many people might have been there at any one time, the best estimate is around about 150 maximum. That's to do with the amount of space, how much rainfall they could actually get and use as a water supply, and how much food they could grow. Because they also found evidence that they were growing crops around in the area, which might seem very strange for a barren area, but they must have found a way of irrigating it. So they grew barley and date palms and things like that. And they had animals. They found animal bones. They also found a lot of coins. So they weren't totally, they might have been self-sufficient, but obviously it looks like they went and traded. But all the coins were found in three jars in the same place, which suggested very strongly that they had their own treasury, if you like. Nobody had their own money. When people came to this community, they gave up all their own personal wealth and so on and joined the community. So that was the nature of the place. And you can understand why, therefore, these Catholic and Christian early explorers assumed, we found a monastery here. And they started to equate it with something perhaps from early Christianity or just before Christianity that was more of a monastic kind. And it wasn't until later when Israeli scholars were able to come on board and help out with understanding the scrolls, and they said, no, this is a very particular Jewish sect. And everything that we're going to see and read in the scrolls, this is what the scholars were saying, actually is all very much about Judaism. Because in those days, 47, 48, early 50s, nobody knew that much about Judaism of this period like they do now. In fact, the discovery of these scrolls revolutionized the way that Christians came to see and understand the Jewish sects of the time, the Judaism around the time of Jesus. So as well as having an impact upon Bible texts, it very much helped them to understand stuff about how Judaism flourished at that time and the problems that they had, the divisions that they had. More on that later, I guess. So I just wanted more pictures because then people have done a reconstruction of what it must have been like. Where again you can see that there's the tower that we saw the ruins of and the water and the cisterns coming through here and all these different areas. In the scriptorium they even found sort of like writing desks and all the equivalent places where they would sit and write and equipment like that. So they could very much tell what it was. And here's some of the scroll caves to try and orientate us back towards some of the nearby ones. That's probably 4 and 5. And I think I've found more pictures of what someone thought it was like. Oop, that's a nice one, but that's just a plan of, again, what it looked like. Again, the tower sort of orientates you as to where you are and the cisterns and these various places. Obviously, they made pottery. They made their own jars. Maybe later on, I'll just say a bit about that, that they are unique to this particular community. So you don't find them anywhere else, the way they made them. And that makes it look a very nice sort of place to go and spend your holiday near the sea. I think it's a bit fanciful, that one, but... Again, it shows you just something of the location, particularly with all the caves up here. And that's another reproduction of what it might have looked like. So it's the next thing actually is the jars. They look something like that. The main feature of them was that they were very... tall, thin, but actually with a large opening and with just a lid on it rather than a seal. So they seem to make them in a very special way. And one of the things about the features of them is that because you just had a lid that popped on the top, it meant that they could open them on a Sabbath. There was no work involved. Whereas if it had been sealed up in some way, then that would involve work. So, and also it meant that you can't pour out of something if you put liquid in it. They weren't made specially for the scrolls. They used these for all sorts of things. But the they obviously decided when they needed to hide the scrolls that these jars would work very well for that. And probably some of them were made for that purpose anyway, storing them. But you couldn't pour liquid out very, very easily because the opening's too big. But you could dip another smaller vessel into it, and if it was full of water, you could draw water out of it that way. That's just, again, a bit more what they're like, because they're quite a distinctive sort of feature. Now, these scrolls, then, they're now designated in certain ways. For instance, scroll 1QS means it was found in cave 1. Q always stands for Qumran, so there's always a Q there. And then after it comes another name or letter or number as to what it might be. So some of them are important enough to have a letter based upon what it is. So this community rule that I told you about or the manual of discipline, where they gave all the rules and organization of the community, that was important enough to be designated 1QS, S meaning Serek, rule Ha Yahad. And Yahad was the word they used for themselves. That's how they called themselves. They were a community. So this is the rule of the community. So it becomes known as 1QS. Another example would be 11QT. So it was found in Cave 11 in Qumran. And this is the temple scroll, which is another one that we might say a bit more about later. And each scroll had a column number. Each scroll was written up in columns. And then each column obviously was made up of lines. So when I show you some later, you'll probably see that feature. But you then could say that you were looking at 11QT, column 5, line 12, for instance. So that's how scholars eventually came to designate exactly which bit. Because each of the scrolls were, they were obviously done and sometimes sort of sewn together as well. So some of them were very, very long, in other words. And as well as column numbers, line numbers. So for instance, these two scrolls of Isaiah, were known as IQ Isaiah A, IQ Isaiah B, 1Q, that is, 1Q, Cave 1, Qumran, Isaiah Scroll A, Isaiah Scroll B. Or some of them so small, fragmentary, not worth a separate name, it's just 4Q177, you know, found 500 bits in this Cave 4, this is number 177 of them. So when they brought them out very specifically in order so that they could put a designation like that to them. Now, in terms of the publication of them, the first seven came out very quickly. But after that, although all these other scrolls have been found, and of course they were then handed over to scholars in different places for personal study, there wasn't just sort of one centre where they all were and one group of scholars working on them all. Sometimes it took a long, long time before they were published and people really knew what was in them. And that led to a lot of conspiracies, if you like, about what was really going on. But what was really going on was that the scholars were being extremely cautious. There was no conspiracy behind all this, although people tended to come up with conspiracies. What have they found? Is this going to overturn everything we thought we knew about Christianity and so on? The answer is no, there's nothing at all in the scrolls that suggests anything about Judaism or Christianity that our Bibles are contrary to. Or was there some conspiracy with someone trying to hide something? No, all that was happening was that scholars were making absolutely sure they got it right before they published. Because the last thing a scholar wants is he sets it all out there, two or three years later, another scholar comes along and completes the work. And you go, oh no, that was my work, that was my job. I want to be known for doing that. So the scholar always wants to have the final word on anything. So if it's going to take them 10 years, 20 years, fine. And given the state of some of them, it was going to take them a very long time. So some texts took 40 years before they were actually published. And it wasn't until 2002 that every single one of these documents was now published and available. And say some of them were very long, some of them are just fragments. So the sort of things they had to work with, and I'm not too sure exactly what these are, but some of them looked quite decent, and except for a bit of sort of decay around the edges, that would be very easy to read. That's what I mean by it being in columns. But something like this, I mean, how on earth do you make sense of some of this, even if you know quite where these other bits go? So there's a lot of work needed to try and understand exactly what they were seeing in each case. And of course, in some cases, there were several copies of one document, but they were all in fragmentary form. So it was a little bit like trying to do a jigsaw puzzle, where you've got several pieces from one puzzle and several from another and so on, to try and work out what the whole picture was. Again, that's the sort of thing that they might have had to work on. Most of the scrolls that they found were in Hebrew. In fact, all the biblical ones, the 230 biblical ones, were in Hebrew or in Aramaic, if that part of the Old Testament was in Aramaic. So in other words, it wasn't an Aramaic version of something in Hebrew. It was in Aramaic originally in the Old Testament. Of all the other scrolls, the ones that are about the group itself or other groups, they were mainly in Hebrew, 80% in Hebrew, 17% in Aramaic, 3% in Greek. But the longest scrolls were all in Hebrew. So when you add it all together and work out how much is in Hebrew, it was at 90%. But like I've explained before, there was also a special kind of Hebrew that they were using that wasn't found anywhere else in some of their scrolls. But even biblical Hebrew has changed over the time. There's, you know, standard biblical Hebrew, later biblical Hebrew, and so on. So languages do change. Well, how did they get there in these caves? Well, the common idea is that by the time that the Roman army was marching through the place, they knew that they were in trouble. And the site was abandoned in AD 68 as the Roman legions marched through Judea. On their way to Jerusalem, they were going to lay siege to Jerusalem and eventually Masada in AD 73. So the natural thing to do with your priceless possessions and these scrolls is hide them in nearby caves. The idea being that when all this trouble is over, we'll be able to go back and get them out again. But of course, it never was over for them in that sense, because the Romans, as I just said, they captured Jerusalem or besieged Jerusalem. They destroyed all the Jews in Masada. Some of the Jews in Qumran may well have fled to Masada. In fact, one or two of their scrolls were found there as well. So it looks like they were deposited there as a sort of hiding place in a temporary sense, but they never got back. Who were they? Well, the common view now, the dominant view, is that this was what were known as the Essenes. So if you've heard of the Essenes, not all Essenes would be in that community. Some Essenes also lived in Jerusalem, maybe other places. But this was a community exclusively of Essenes. Now, there have been hints of this in writings like Josephus and even Pliny, that there was a sect called the Essenes with their own very peculiar ways of doing things. So they were known about, but this discovery of the place, together with their writings, very much seemed to indicate, oh yes, we found them. And we now know what part they played within the whole scheme of things with Pharisees and Sadducees and other groups like that. So although not everybody is totally convinced that this is an Essene community, and that's why I've sort of avoided using that word up to now. I've talked about the Dead Sea sect or the Qumran community. The chances are these were Essenes, if you read more about them. I've said that the size of the group at any time would probably be no more than 150 to 200. And everybody always wants to know, were they totally men? Were they just a male community? Were there any women there? And the common view, particularly with some writings about them being celibate, is that they were entirely a male community. But some of their documents suggest that they did actually have women there. So it remains a little bit open. And this cemetery nearby is interesting because they found graves there, bones of about 1,100 people. And there were probably some female skeletons within the cemetery. But it's also likely that there were many other people buried in that cemetery other than just people from the Essene community. So that doesn't seem to be conclusive either. But perhaps they weren't quite the monastic all-male group that was originally thought. But these documents talk about their daily life, the routine that they had. They did more than just write out the scriptures. They did grow things, make things. They're not just the pottery that we've seen, but also basketware and things like that. They had their prayer life and routines. They had their own calendar. And it's a very complicated thing. But again, it's part of wanting to be separate from Jerusalem and the mainstream of Judaism, that they decided that they would have a slightly different calendar. And I think instead of it being just sort of lunisolar, it was entirely solar or something. But it does mean that they celebrated some of the feasts at slightly different times, probably a day or so out. So that's one of the things that's clear from their documents, that their calendar differed. But they lived a very strong Jewish life in terms of they had the blessings, they had these communal meals, they had their ritual immersion baths, they had their initiation rites, probably involving giving up all your money to join the community. I'll tell you about this later, but they had their disciplines and their punishments that they meted out, and spent a lot of time, obviously, in prayer and in the scriptures. They regarded themselves really as a pure form of Judaism. Let's get away from all the corruption. It was a bit of a holy huddle from that point of view. And we are the sons of light, and come the big final battle, God's on our side. And as I say, they developed this variation of Hebrew as a sort of anti-language, really. So the value of these scrolls to scholars has been immense. It showed so much more about Judaism that people hadn't understood. Because there wasn't enough documentary evidence from that time of these different groups. It also showed a background to Christianity and so on. What happened to them? Well, as I said, when the Roman legions came marching through, they abandoned the site, they fled. Perhaps some went to Masada and they never came back. So the site then was just left for ages and ages until it was excavated and again in the 40s and 50s. So just to finish off for a couple more minutes, this main bit. Other important scrolls besides the main seven that were found to start with. Again, these are ones that I can say a little bit more about if you want to pick one or two, but I'll tell you some of the most interesting things. Halakhic. Halakha is to do with the way you live, as opposed to your doctrines, your beliefs. This is your lifestyle. And this very important, it's just called a letter, but it's a very important document, shows how they were meant to live and how they differed from other Jewish groups. In fact, they had more disagreements over what turns to be very trivial ways of living, minute details in their law. But that was what really set them apart from others. One of them was called the Damascus document, which is most weird, because actually it was first found in Cairo. There was another major find of 200,000 Jewish documents in a sort of backroom storeroom of a synagogue in Cairo in the 1890s, I think, sometime before these were found. And there was this document which related it was a medieval document, but clearly related back a lot earlier. And then they found fragments of it and copies of it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they began to understand better what it was. But by then it was designated as the Damascus document. The reason it's Damascus, it's a bit complicated to explain, but they were trying to explain themselves and their community as the place of exile that God wanted them to be. So whereas Damascus in the past had been a bad place that the Jews were sent to, they completely turned the whole thing around and said, oh no, we're Damascus and we're in exile as the true Jews, come and join us. The temple scroll, which I mentioned before, this is the longest one, about 9 meters long. So there's a lot of detail in the temple scroll, which is very strange given they didn't have a temple. And given that they were actually out there in the desert in order to avoid the temple and its practices. But they had a temple scroll. And then one that's absolutely fascinating, and I must tell you about this one, called a copper scroll, because it's inscribed on copper. And that's very, very rare to have something inscribed on metal at all. And this was very, very difficult to sort of prize apart without it disintegrating and to read what was on it. But when they eventually did that and they had to send it to Manchester to be able to read it in a lab there, they discovered it was a bit of a treasure map with lots of details as to where lots of wealth was buried. So I might tell you a bit more about that one. And you might recognize that. That is the Shrine of the Book, as it's called, in Israel. And that was built around 1965 to house most of the scrolls. Some of them were still in Jordan. I think the copper scroll is still in Jordan. But that's where you go today if you want to see them. And it's shaped like the lid of one of the jars. It obviously looks as though it's well watered for some reason, but and obviously you can see that that's not the main building. The building is downstairs, it's underground. So when you go in, it looks something like that. Perhaps if you've been there, some of you might want to share on that. I suppose the scrolls are around the edges here, and in the middle here, which looks like one of the Torah scroll things, that's where, I'm fairly sure that's where the main Isaiah scroll is, put around there. Right, well, you've listened to me for ages and ages. I'm going to stop sharing there, check that you're still here. And in the 5 minutes before we go outside, firstly, any questions on anything I've said, any comments that you could add to that, or which scroll would you most like to talk more about that?
Yeah.
Aramaic. To know the difference. Oh,
thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. I've looked down on K4, I now realise, and know a tremendous amount that I didn't know then. So thank you. I was just wondering, I've got an idea that I thought that John the Baptist might have been in some sect like this or something.
Yes.
That was wrong information.
No. I think it's a very bandy thing, although it's not clear. But he may well have joined that community at some point. And the argument is that because his parents were quite old, he might have been orphaned very early. And I heard it said that this community took in male orphans. But there's nothing in my reading on this that said that they did. But a lot of his features do suggest that he might have been part of that community until he was called out by God to be a voice in the wilderness in preparation for Messiah. So in that sense, the Essenes are not really a preparation for Messiah. They had their own view of Messiah. They believed in two different Messiahs, a kingly one and a priestly one. But John may well have been part of it for a while and may well have been influenced by them. Yeah.
Jackie?
I was just be quite interested in the two Isaiah scrolls, as in what's the difference between them? Because I was in that Dome of the Book, whatever it's called.
Shrine of the Book.
Shrine of the Book, aye. And it was Isaiah that was in the middle, because I actually took a photo until somebody told me I wasn't supposed to.
I'm only half hearing you, I'm afraid. You're breaking up.
Oh, sorry.
I was intrigued. Someone told you off, did you say?
Because I took a photo of the Isaiah Ooh. Scroll in the middle.
Ooh. No photos. Yeah.
Didn't realise.
So you've been there and you've seen that, have you then? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating. Yeah. And I loved it.
Great. Betty?
Yeah, I'm interested in the Isaiah scrolls as well. Is Isaiah 53 in there by any chance?
Well, in the complete one, yes.
It is complete. Okay, thank you.
The complete version is in the language that they've updated. It doesn't change the meaning of it. It's just that it's like if you're reading Shakespeare, you might want to make it a little bit more intelligible by using some more words. So that's all they did on that. But the incomplete one is in exactly the same Hebrew as the later manuscripts, the Masoretic text that ours is from. But the complete one is slightly different.
I think we've got Pat first, then John and Lynn, and then Christine.
This is just a quick question. Did you say that they originated in Damascus before they went to...
just that one scroll. And the scroll wasn't in Damascus. That's not right either. So they were found in Cairo. It's called the Damascus Document because it talks about Damascus, but this group have redefined their community as Damascus, because Damascus was a place of exile for the Jews, and so they reinterpreted their group as an equivalent exile. So don't get any more sort of confused on that. From our point of view, it's not the most interesting one either. So,
okay, sure. It's a quick one, John and Lynn, and then Christine, and then we go and clap.
I'd love to hear more about the copper one.
Yeah.
I don't think there was actually any mention of it, well, I could be wrong, in the Shrine of the Book.
No, because that one is still in Jordan.
Oh.
Yeah. I will certainly talk about that one, probably make it top of the list when you come back.
Oh, good, eh?
I'll show you pictures of it, because it's amazing to see it's been inscribed on copper.
I bet, yeah. I'll look at
that one. And one more quick one then before the break.
Yes, Christine.
Hi, did they find any books from the Apocrypha, like the Book of Enoch?
Yes, they did. Enoch and Jubilees.
Wow. Okay.
I'll certainly talk about the biblical books again that they found. But the point is, it said the canon wasn't fixed then. Mm-hmm. So some of these books were regarded as almost equivalent to some of the lesser biblical books. But yeah, I'll pick that up as well.
Okay.
Okay. I'll see you back in 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so if you want one shortish, simple paperback to read about the Dead Sea Scrolls, my main recommendation is the Dead Sea Scrolls in English by Geza Vermes. That's Geza and Vermes. And there's a penguin version of that. There's one or two others that are probably quite good, but that contains most of it, most of what you could possibly want if you did want to do some more. So you might still have got lots of questions left over from before, as well as dipping into two or three of these scrolls in particular. Does anyone want to start with a question from anything that has already been said? And you puzzled over still, or no?
No hands going.
Well, okay. I don't know whether people are trying to raise a physical hand. Is Aggie? Do you want to say something?
Oh, yes, we've got Aggie.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be clear in my mind then about the Essenes and the Dead Sea Scrolls, that they're not necessarily connected.
Well, the dominant scholarly view is that they are.
Oh, right.
There's always some, I mean, in the scholarly world, as you probably know, there's always some oddbods that come up with all sorts of different options. Some of them don't even believe the manuscripts belong to that period, but belong later. No, I think we can assume that the Essenes were the people in that community and they were responsible for this sort of thing. So, any other questions before we... Okay, let me try and see if I can get this going again. Right. I don't mind you leaving people unmuted if they want to come in and ask questions rather than me just give another talk.
Right.
If you get noisy, you'll have to sort of mute them individually, but by all means, leave it a bit freer this time.
Okay, unmute all.
Okay, so if you're
not unmuted, you should be able to unmute yourself, because that's why not. Actually, you can't. Let me try that. It's not happening. There you go. Right, everybody's unmuted.
What I should be able to do now, as I say, leap in with anything at any time now, I don't mind. But this is the copper scroll. So this one is still in Jordan, in its own special case. And you can see that it's not all that complete in places. And that's what it looks like close up. It was very, very unusual to find anything inscribed on metal. So this is the only one that's not on papyrus. The copper sheets were rolled up together, but when it was initially found, there's no way they're going to try and unroll it because it would just fall apart. So it was eventually sent off in 1956 by the Jordanian authorities to the Manchester College of Science and Technology, where they made a completely new machine that could manage to cut it up into sheets in such a way that it could then be put back together again for reading purposes. And that's when they discovered there were two separate scrolls, but they're really one document. It wasn't until that happened that they realized they were dealing with one document. The sheets are 99% copper, only a millimeter thin. And unlike the others that were sewn together, these were fastened together with rivets, in the sheets were, and then rolled up. And this one is still in, well, as of my information, in the Amman Archaeological Museum. But what it actually tells you about, as well as being extremely... I'm looking at the wrong one here. The wrong presentation. But it was two separate rolls, 12 columns altogether. I've just told you all this stuff. So, but it was a treasure map, or not a map, but a description of treasure. It talks of 64 different hiding places where you could find treasure. And actually, people therefore thought, does this really belong to the Qumran community? Had they really got all this treasure hidden elsewhere? And the sort of description... quite interesting. Here's one, for instance. In the cave of the old washer's house on the third ledge, you'll find 65 gold bars. In the underground cavity that is in the courtyard of the House of Logs, in the midst of which is a recess, vessels and silver, 70 talents.
Wow.
And it goes on and on like this, with something like 64 different hiding places in Jerusalem, the Judean desert, and elsewhere. And it even tells you in this place to make sure you get the angle right before you start digging and how far down you dig and what you'll find. It's extraordinary.
Has anything been found?
I knew someone would ask that. No, people have found their places, no treasure, just other artifacts. So that's a bit mysterious. But if you add up all the treasure that's mentioned in this scroll, it comes to 1,300 talents of gold plus 65 separate bars of gold. This might not mean much to you yet, but it will in a minute. 3,000 talents of silver and all these other vessels. Put it all together, and in modern terms, it's 26 tons of gold and 65 tons of silver hidden. It is staggering. And as I say, no one's found anything, even though they've tried. So there is a lot of debate about whether this really did belong to the Qumran community. Why would they be hoarding all this? What was the point of it? Were they actually saving up in order to be able to one day build their own temple? So they're completely independent. No one really knows. And that's why some people think it might even have been the temple treasury itself, and therefore this is a temple scroll that somehow got hidden in one of these caves as well. But that's particularly extraordinary, that one. Any other questions before I pull up another one? I know we ought to look at the biblical text. Where are they gone? Okay, make sure I've got myself. There's far more, well, as I said, there's, what did I say, 230 of them. It's far more than just the Isaiah scrolls, although people know of those more than anything else. This is the large Isaiah scroll from Cave 1, and bits of it. But you can see as well that this obviously is where Isaiah 7:15 is, and 7:14, and that's someone trying to put that into perspective. And there's, but there's even some gaps here. And that's what you must have seen, Jackie, in the Shrine of the Book, presumably. If you're still there.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that might be another picture of it in the same sort of place. So it's quite well preserved, but a bit tatty around the edges. Then I think we will be in another 1,000 years or so, won't we? Actually, we won't. We'll have our new bodies, so that's a bit too morbid. So there were lots of different biblical books. As I say, everything except for Esther. And I've already explained that they were 1,000 years earlier. The only complete one is this particular one of Isaiah, which is not the Masoretic text, but is linguistically updated. In terms of the amounts of the other books, there's only those two of Isaiah, but there are 34 copies of the Book of Psalms, 27 copies of the Book of Deuteronomy, or partial copies, I should say, because some of these may well be fragments. I've got 24 of Isaiah. Why have I now got 24 of Isaiah? Am I contradicting myself here? Let me just... I suppose the other fragments. Yeah, okay. So there are 24 more bits of Isaiah.
Something that I read last week, there's a fragment, I can't remember where it was, that they thought had nothing on it. Revealed some text that is being looked into as we speak.
Oh, okay. That was from this area, from this group.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard of that, but it doesn't strike me as unlikely.
You're saying 34 copies.
The point about I'm getting it here is that it's interesting that these three books, Psalms, Deuteronomy, and Isaiah, are the most quoted in the New Testament. And it seems to be the ones that they copied out more than any others. So they regarded them as particularly important. After that, there's 20 copies of Genesis, or partial copies, then Exodus, then Leviticus, and then we go on from there. But one of the Psalms ones is particularly well preserved. And this is where, if you've heard of other Psalms besides the 150 that we have, their copies of the books of Psalms have all the canonical ones, but often in a different order. Remember, I talked about the Psalms a few weeks ago, and now the order of them in five books, and they've got five more at the end. And so if you ever come across Psalm 151, which is a short eight-verse psalm about David, almost about his life, that's where this sort of thing comes from. There's also a copy of Job in Aramaic, don't know why, and nine of the Torah scrolls are in what's called Paleo-Hebrew. Now, Paleo-Hebrew is an earlier form of Hebrew, which is more picture form, almost hieroglyphic. And in fact, something very unusual tends to happen in these Torah scrolls. Every time, so not these, by the way, sorry, the others. Every time you come across the name of God or Yahweh, the four letters, they revert to the Paleo version of it. That's in normal Hebrew scrolls. Okay, so these are entirely in Paleo Hebrew for some reason. And they often, though, reverted to putting the name of God in that ancient form in other ones that were purely in Hebrew. But then there's one or two scrolls where they don't do that. But most of them are in the Masoretic text that we're now familiar with. Not that it's called the Masoretic text then. Sometimes they diverge a little bit, some of these, and the occasional variants. There's even a few extra verses stuck in from time to time. For instance, in 1 Samuel 11, almost explanatory verses, as though we don't quite have enough detail about this guy, so we'll put a bit more in for you. But those sort of variants died out later on and didn't eventually become part of it. But it is interesting that the Torah, the Prophets and the Psalms are the only books by then, and therefore also by the time of Jesus, that we would now call canonical. Because they didn't really fix their canon till later. But obviously everybody regarded the five books of Moses, the Prophets and the Psalms as being the main stuff. But also, as was mentioned earlier then, regarded as sort of on the fringes of this, like some of the other books, were Enoch, 11 copies of Enoch, 18 copies of the Jubilees, if you're familiar with those books. So that shows that they did regard them as having some worth and some value, even though they eventually were kicked out of the main canon. And fragments were found of other books that we now call the apocryphal books. And a lot of their other texts retell parts of the biblical stories. We wouldn't call them a biblical text, not a copy of anything we've now got. But they picked something like the Ten Plagues and did a text on that, a document based upon that. Probably like this Genesis Apocryphon, where they expansively retold some of the Genesis stories. Any questions, or anyone want to pick a scroll, any scroll? As long as I've got it here. Can I tell you something while you're thinking? We may not look at this all together. So I'm determined to tell you in there. Two hands are raised. So can you find them, please?
Right, yes. Christine?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
You mentioned the book of well.
Not hearing you now, sorry.
You mentioned the book of 12. What is the book of 12?
Okay, that's the 12 minor prophets.
Oh, 12 minor prophets.
We have separate books. They put them together as the book of 12.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's what that is. Okay, some more hands up. We'll take those.
Yeah, then. Monica? Hang on, I need to unmute you.
Mute now.
Yeah.
Okay, am I unmuted? Yeah.
You are.
Okay. The Halakhic one.
Yeah.
You referred to was the their own laws?
It contained a lot of their basically, they're the precepts of Torah, but how to live them out.
Oh, right.
It would be like an early form of, not Midrash, Talmud, perhaps. It was also lots of disagreements which differentiated them as a sect from the Sadducees and the Pharisees. They talk a lot about us, we, and them. But it was how to deal with animal hides and pregnant animals, things of great contention to the Jews of the time. But it was how to interpret the precepts of Torah, that their own rules were in the community rule or the manual of discipline. That's where their particular practice is.
Right, because I thought it might, the other one, the one that you just mentioned, it might have reflected if it was a mixed community or male only.
Yeah.
Had rules and regulations.
Let me try and find that, because there are one or two documents where it does suggest that there were females. The point is that people like Josephus and Philo, writing about the Essene sect, said they're entirely male. And then you come up with all their documents, and a lot of their documents, you wouldn't think there were any females, but one or two suggest that they are. So maybe at some point they went sort of mixed, you know, like schools did or something. I would try and find this quickly.
It's just a quick question, were they all Jews?
Yes. Yes. I've got no reason to say anything other than yes to that. That sounded very dogmatic, but it made me think at the same time. But I got...
I thought maybe because you said in the cemetery there were some female bones, that they might have brought females in just to do, I don't know, domestic stuff, stuff that they couldn't feel they could do themselves.
Where did you get that idea from?
Well, typical, wouldn't it?
The cemetery may not have been just for them. It wasn't in their community as such. It was outside. I mean, they never buried people inside their own community. And there seems to be an awful lot more skeletons there than probably ever at that site. And some of them, they're not easy to date. Some of them are probably later than the actual community itself. So keep asking questions.
Okay, Jeremy.
Thank you. I was interested about the Book of Enoch, mentioned, of course, in Jude.
Yeah.
And from my memory, there was a part in that where the sun was to come in through various portholes and so on. So perhaps that connected with their solar calendar rather than looking at...
Yes, it might be. But again, it shows the fact that it's quoted by a New Testament writer, that even in the first century, they hadn't yet fully decided that those books are not going to be... I mean, you didn't have to worry about it because you weren't producing a single volume. You just had a collection of separate scrolls. So you didn't have to work out, you know, which ones to include in the publication. But some eventually dropped out of use, and others became regarded as more canonical. But that's why a book like Enoch would be quoted in the New Testament. Yeah,
it is the bit of it which seems the most fanciful. So maybe that's
But they based it upon the fact that, you know, in Genesis it says Enoch suddenly wasn't there anymore. He walked with God and then wasn't. So I think what they've done is they've sort of filled in a few more details and brought him back to say a bit more. So any other questions at the moment?
Yes, Betty.
Yes. Who are the sons of darkness, Paul? Are they just anybody that wasn't them?
Yeah, well, other Jews.
Any other Jews that weren't part of their group?
Exactly. Not pagans, not Romans. Their battle was not with the others. They never mention the others, so they're not worth it. It's all about them and other Jews and how they've got it right. And, you know, their understanding of the Torah, the fact that the temple had become corrupt and they didn't want anything to do with that. It's the usual sort of idea of mainstream religion has gone wrong, so a sect hives itself off, and then it argues within that particular sect.
Yeah.
So,
nothing changes, does it?
It doesn't. They had the same debates. And having done predestination last time, and I said this briefly at the end, they were very strong predestination people. The Sadducees were totally free will people, and the Pharisees said, well, it could be both. So they're the middle. But some of the Dead Sea Scroll comments are very, very strongly predestination. And so it's almost like we are the chosen ones out of the chosen ones, you know, the chosen of the chosen kind of thing.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, we have a question, if I can of Lynn. Lynn and John. Okay?
Yeah.
I was wondering, what were the punishments you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I know. I'm heading towards that when I find it. You've been distracted by other questions, which is fine. But I want to read them out properly rather than just try and mention them. I'm also trying to find out a bit more about this. Here we are. This is the women bit coming back to. So they're firstly thought to be totally celibate. There's no references to women in their own community rule. And comments from people like Josephus and so on suggested that at least some were celibate. But there are references to women in this Damascus document and the war scroll. Given the war scroll is about army life and how to win a religious war, that's a bit strange. So there are a few occasional references to women in a couple of their documents. The punishments. Well, the punishments will be in their manual of discipline. Oh, okay. Here we go. Now, the punishment was always confinement, okay? It doesn't say how they confined people, but it shows they took their discipline seriously. So, for speaking foolishly, 3 months of confinement. 3 months, just for speaking foolishly. Interrupting another member when he was speaking, 10 days. Spitting during a meeting, 30 days. Falling asleep during a meeting, 3 months. And here's, get rid of this one. Exposing your nakedness in public, 6 months. So, you know, they had their rules and they kept them. One other thing I must mention is that in a lot of their documents, they refer to their leader and they give him the title Teacher of Righteousness. Now, that is never discovered that he was a particular individual. It might even have just been a figurehead. It wasn't necessarily, you know, the main guy in charge. They seem to have overseers, people in charge. But when they're writings, they say they are following the Teacher of Righteousness, whereas their opponents, the Sons of Darkness, they followed the Wicked Priest, which might have been a reference to the High Priest in Jerusalem, who they regarded as the Wicked Priest, whoever it was. But the Teacher of Righteousness doesn't become a particular figure, so it might have been a totally anonymous sort of thing. But the parts of their documents say that he is telling them how to do these things. And also some of the hymns of praise are by him. But so he's a mysterious figure, but he's not the equivalent of their Messiah or anything like that. Any other questions?
Are you going to do something on the war scroll?
Okay, here it comes then. You can see it now, can you? You see my screen?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it describes the cataclysmic final battle between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. That the word Milhammer means war. So, Cave 1, Qumran, the scroll on war. There's one large document and then 8 other fragments which were found. So, if I just run through this presentation, it'll say everything I could think of. But it's about all evil will be destroyed at the appointed time and God's rule will be established. So, it's a very apocalyptic one. Oh, and there are other. Main belief is dualism. Dualism is where you believe that there are two gods, one good, one bad, and they'll eventually fight it out and sort it out that way. This, again, is based upon the light and darkness sort of idea. And predestination comes into this. I mean, their predestination is so strong that once you are predestined, you cannot do anything wrong. So even if you think about sinning, because you're predestined, it's not going to happen. Well, like that.
But they wouldn't have needed those rules then.
No, they wouldn't. But this text is expressed in very strong language. There's an introduction. Then comes the rules of battle. And they seem to have taken the Roman legions as their main model, but also showing how the priests had a role to lead them into a religious war. It's probably based upon everything in the Old Testament about warfare and what they knew about modern warfare from the Romans. And then the final section is this. This is what you've been waiting for, chaps. Here's the big battle coming up. And at the end, oh, we win. Great. So that's an outline of what it's about. Any other questions or?
Yes, predestination. Two gods, they said.
Yeah, one good, one bad.
Don't they mean the devil?
No.
Is that a question in the background now?
No, I think it was a conversation.
A conversation, right? Now, the only other one, I just want to stress, you know, this Pesha thing, the one example on this, let's just say, but not as we know it. It's not a commentary. It's totally separate from any original context and meaning. It's not trying to help us understand Habakkuk, the Babylonians coming. I'm trying to find a particular example because they do this sort of commentary on all these different things. They're pretty useless. But the Habakkuk one is the main one. They do the whole of chapters 1 and 2. But they update the Babylonians to the Romans. So nothing in their comments can be actually found in the biblical text. This is where they refer a lot to the wicked priest and the teacher of righteousness. They're good guy and everyone else is bad guy. Unknown, but as such. The bit I'm trying to get to, Habakkuk 2:4 is the just shall live by faith. Okay, that's why I picked this verse, or the righteous will live by their faithfulness. Okay, and that's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. But which means that the New Testament writers think this is an important verse and we can explain it within the context of faith in Jesus. So it's not just an Old Testament text. This means something to us in New Covenant terms. That's fine. They say this verse concerns all those who observe the law in the house of Judah, whom God will deliver from the house of judgment because of their suffering and because of their faith in the teacher of righteousness. In other words, you've got to be part of our group again. So everything is twisted and reorientated to them, their situation and so on. And you'd never get that just from a biblical text like Habakkuk 2:4. So, it's a shame because if they found real commentaries on this, you might get some understanding as to how the Jews understood their own scriptures. Mm. We don't from this. Aggie, hand up.
I was just wondering how significant then overall the influence of this group would have been to the intertestamental development of Judaism.
Hmm.
In view of the fact they were a bit off the beaten path.
Yeah. What a good question. You see, we tend to know Judaism from, if you like, the survivors, the winners, the Pharisaic group, the ones that survived after AD 70. That was just the Pharisees who went up north and became Rabbinic Judaism. The Sadducees died out. The Essenes died out. It's assumed that, I mean, Jesus obviously didn't seem to have much to do with them, but you might know that it's thought that he used an Essene house in Jerusalem for the Last Supper. And that's why he seemed to do it the day before Passover lambs were slaughtered, because he was doing it in within their community. But there's no other evidence that he had anything to do with them as such. As I said, maybe John the Baptist did. They were just one smallish strand within...
In her late teens, she began asking herself, is this real?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I can't answer it in any more detail, but you see, nothing was known about them until this was really discovered. Only little snippets in Philo and Josephus and so on. And so it was quite astonishing when these texts were discovered. And it was only later that they thought, oh, this is probably the Essene sect then. Which is why it became the dominant view. But it all depends whether or not you think that, because they were stricter in so many ways, and I could have given you loads of examples of how they interpret, in the Halakha sense, they interpret the laws much more stricter than the Pharisees were doing. You could say, well, that puts them on the extreme edge, or perhaps it's actually them getting to grips with what God really wanted, but they still had these extra strange ideas. I'm not an expert in the rest of that, so.
Thank you.
Any other questions then? Oh, the temple scroll, just one, and Christine's got a hand up, but I'll give this a minute. But you got a question, Christine?
Yeah, there is a text called the Pierced Messiah text in the scroll. Is that the same as the war scroll?
I'll have to double check that. I know what you mean, though, because there's some debate over whether it is the Pierced Messiah or the Piercing Messiah. They couldn't quite work out which of the two it was, and that makes a difference. But I've heard of it. Any other questions while I'm trying to find my answer to that? I think the point is, don't assume that even if it is the Pierced Messiah, it's any reference or prophetic reference to Jesus.
Another question here from Jeremy, if I can.
Thank you, Paul. Pesha, I was interested, I was glad to hear you talk a bit more about Pesha Habakkuk, because I thought it meant understanding. And I wondered if it meant, if it was similar to Peshat in terms of a particular way of looking at the Bible. Or am I making terribly...
I think if one is Peshat and one is Peshat, they're different roots. I'm not sure. They certainly don't relate in that Peshat is the plain, simple understanding and reading of the text before you do Midrash and things. Peshat is even the other end of the scale, really. No.
Thank you. Sorry.
I don't understand more about the derivation of that particular word. So
it's interesting, isn't it, that it's there?
But it's meant to be a commentary because they quote a verse, and then they say, and its Pesha is, and then they give you all this garbage about what it means for them today, which is no use to us. There's another hand up.
Yes. Lynn? John? I'm going to unmute again. What's going on here? Okay. Oh, there's still...
Okay. Maybe a question. How do you do a chat?
How do you do a chat?
You can answer that.
You go to chat at the bottom.
Yeah, I saw that.
Click on it, and then you type in what you want. And you choose who you want to send it to as well.
How do you send it?
You the return button.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think. Monica's got a question. Still muted. Hang on. You unmute yourself there.
Yeah, I'm there. The copper one is mystifying me a bit because I don't know about the production of copper, how they would have printed on it. Can you just clarify about the dating of the copper one?
Oh, okay. Well, no, only that it was found at the same time as the others, but yes, the dating of it. No,
they were able to get paper and print on it, imprint on it.
Well, they would, like you do in stonemasonry and so on, you had a little gadget and you just.
Yeah.
You inscribed into it.
But the fact that they were such thin sheets of copper, the production of it.
Yeah, I know. That's why it is so amazing. The the dating of the scrolls, at the time the scrolls were being found, there was no such thing as carbon-14 dating like they use now. Or it was in its very early stage and it wasn't regarded as reliable. I think later on they might have tried to date them like this. But certainly all the other ones you can put into this time frame for this community. But the whole copper thing is a mystery anyway.
Just a thought on that, as it's such a strange content and everything, and it obviously took a long time to do. Do you think it was somebody who was on their 6 months of...
That was their detention, was it?
Yeah.
Their lockdown.
I thought, I'll get them all going.
I still can't find that Pierce Piercing Messiah. I'll have another go in a minute. But this is the temple scroll. Again, it's fairly well preserved, except for bits of it. And it's very, very long. It's the longest one of all. 9 meters, 67 columns put together. And what it tends to do is it takes a text from the Torah, say from Deuteronomy and Leviticus, which are basically the same law, but in slightly different words, and it puts it together so that all the words are used. So it gives a slightly expanded version of what you do. And instead of it being via Moses, they're spoken entirely by God directly. But it is based upon Deuteronomy, Exodus, and Leviticus. And so it finds common laws in those and puts each bit together to make one law on each bit. And then says, God said that. Here's an example. So Leviticus says, you can't eat the blood of an animal. You have to spill it on the ground and cover it with dirt. Deuteronomy says, you spill it on the ground like water. So the temple scroll says, upon the ground, you shall spill it like water, and then you'll cover it with dirt. So that's covered everything, hasn't it? That does. Okay. But the really interesting bit I'm coming to on this is in all these, because it's so big and so long, it does all these different sections, and it's like you're about to build a temple. And you think, why are they doing this? Because they can't build a temple. And when you get to the end, I've forgotten the measurements here. Let's go through all this. It's the only temple that's written as a square. All the other biblical temples are rectangular. It's 1,600 cubits on each side. Now, you probably haven't done much cubic measurement recently, so I'll translate that for you into about half a mile by half a mile. That's the temple. 160 acres, the equivalent of all Jerusalem then and of the old city today. And given that even Solomon's temple was only 60 by 20, and even Herod's was 200 by 8 by 80, their description of a temple this big is totally unrealistic, and they were never going to be able to build it. So it must be a fanciful thing.
See, in the New Jerusalem, when it describes it, it's not. It's a 1,500. It comes into my mind. Is it miles? Or is it?
Yes.
What's the units involved? I can't remember.
I was trying to remember.
It's huge. It's very big.
Definitely. Oh, yes. In Revelation it is, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Question from Jackie.
Paul, I attended a seminar once, about 5 years ago, and I can't remember the exact details right now, but the guy said to write a Torah scroll. I'm sure it took years to write, the first five books of the law, even. Mm. In my head, I'm going for 10 years, but I can't think at the moment. Do you have any information on that?
No, but you're right, it would take a long time because they had to do it letter by letter very, very carefully, didn't they?
Yeah, and even they had to count the gaps as well.
Yes. And obviously if they went wrong, they had to throw it away and start again or something. But they spent a lot of time copying out things. It wasn't their only reason for being there. But I think it said they would spend even a third of every night in the scriptorium, probably in sort of shifts or something. It was the main thing that they did. And I think they made their own ink.
Yeah, I think they did. And they used, like, calf as the hide.
Yes, they did. That's right. And so it wasn't all papyrus. A lot of it was vellum. And the actual job of skinning the animal and drying it and tanning it or whatever they had to do in preparation was another major skill. And then I think they made the ink. Even some of the ink was red. I don't know where they got that dye from, but otherwise it was black because they used soot or something to mix it. So,
okay, thank you. If I find the document or the details, I'll let you know.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, I'm glad you found this interesting. We've overrun on time, but there are so many different things. Anyone else got a question?
No.
Sorry, I can't find this pierced piercing Messiah bit quite as quickly as I thought. I've got about 40 pages of notes, you see, on what I did. So blame the lockdown, but I do remember it. I just don't remember where it came up. So, okay. There's no more questions. Shall we stop the recording at least?
Yes.
And I'll stop sharing.